Hello and welcome to the Worn and Wound podcast. We've got a special episode today. We're going to be talking about all of the new releases from Watches and Wonders. Some of the new releases that did not fall under the umbrella of Watches and Wonders. It's a lot. There's a lot of new releases, and we'll talk about them. So we've got today I'm joined by Zach Weiss. Hello, Zach.
Hello, Blake.
I'm also joined by Zach Kazan. Hello, Zach Kazan.
Hey, guys.
And we are happy to be joined by he's a good friend of mine. His name is Reg Brack. Reg, welcome to the Worn and Wound podcast. I'll let you introduce yourself.
Thanks, Blake. And good to see you guys. Happy to be here talking watches. You know, I've had various roles in the watch industry, the industry that I love so much, from private watch dealer to senior positions at Christie's Auction House in the watch department to leading, kicking off StockX watch division to market research leader NPD group, where I was industry analyst for watches and luxury. And now I'm doing consulting. And one of my primary projects is one of my favorite brands, Grand Seiko. So working on two top secret global initiatives for that brand. And hopefully soon we'll be able to announce, but they're really exciting initiatives from that awesome brand. So anyway, happy to be chatting with you chaps.
Yeah, absolutely. Likewise. Appreciate you. Let's ditch the new releases and let's just talk about these two special projects.
Yeah.
I wish. But you know, that brand has come so far, especially in the US in the 3 short years that the current leadership's been running it. And you guys have seen firsthand what they've done, you know, grinding it out with retail partners like Watches of Switzerland, right? You know, events and training and, you know, really boots on the ground. And, you know, I think it's helped fuel that passion, you know, not just within our watch nerd circles, but with general luxury consumers. And now that brand is actually in the top 10, well inside the top 10 in each of the price categories that they play in the US, especially that coveted $5,000 to $7,000, you know, a price band. They're in the top five. So, you know, it's just been phenomenal. So I think the projects that I'm working on with US leadership and also Tokyo leadership will elevate that brand even further with, you know, worldwide luxury consumers, not just watch geeks.
Yeah, absolutely. That's awesome. I mean, yeah, they're just an incredible value in that price range, in that $5,000 to $7,000 range. And incredible. Anyone who's you know, kind of spent time with one or you know, had their hands on one, I think it speaks for itself. And I think that's the real tricky part with these watches, right? They're hard. You can't just walk into any, they're hard to find.
Yeah. And I know you guys like to do a wrist check and, you know, I can show you my SBGW 231, which is a nice go-to for me, the little manual wound 37.3 millimeter, I think, you know, great value. $4,300. Are you kidding me? Zeratsu polishing. But I'm almost wearing it under protest because I thought I'd be wearing my white birch by now, my 005. Yeah. You know, that watch to me is just phenomenal. I've never seen it in the flesh or in the metal.
But you're going to love it. It's gorgeous.
I can't wait. I missed out on the first batch. So hopefully, you know, the second batch will come my way.
Yeah. We've both been to the boutique in the city, the Nature of Time boutique. And I had that one on my wrist for a little while and it was, I mean, I expected it to be very elegant and everything, but it kind of, the subtle changes in the proportions of that case, the bracelet, and then the dramatic dial. I mean, that's really, and you compare it, you know, just to what else is $9,100 that thereabouts on the market. And it's like, it's really some next level stuff. So
I totally agree. I can't wait to see it.
Well, that's, I mean, it was nice to get the Grand Seiko stuff out of the way. That was a few weeks ago that we talked about. And, you know, I think we all came away with that white birch was a big favorite of all of ours. That dial in particular. Wow.
Yeah, stunning.
And not to belabor, but I think a lot of Grand Seiko dials that I've seen have like this subtlety to them. But the white birch just kind of like, and it grabs you right away. There's a lot of contrast there. It's just a gorgeous one. So congratulations on that. Real excited for you there on that pickup. So let's move over to Well, hey, you got to do a wrist check. Yeah, let's see what the other guys got on. Let's see, Zach Weiss, what do you got on?
So I mean, now I feel bad. I didn't realize we were going to talk about Grand Seiko because I had on my SBGA 375 earlier, but then I was like, I wore that last week on the podcast, and that feels like a taboo.
Okay, so I
put on another relevant watch though, Fairlander chronograph, because you know Fair had a release that I'm sure we'll touch on as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, the Carnegie. Yeah. Just this morning, as we record this, which is the hand wound,
New hand chronograph sport,
really sharp dial on that.
Yeah, something else there.
And so. Under $2,000, I mean.
Yeah, like 1955, something like that.
All right, let's. Okay, I want to circle back to this. Zach Zan, what are you wearing?
I'm wearing a watch that I have in for a review. It's the Tribus TR101. It has a really nice teal dial and gunmetal stainless steel case. It's a really, I'm enjoying it. It's a nicely executed watch from a new British brand.
Right.
It's funny because you know how non-watch people, non-watch enthusiasts, it sounds to them like we're all speaking a different language. To me, that's almost how it is talking to you guys, because you cover and you live in that emerging independent brand watch world. So, you know, brands like Tribus, I mean, it's they come fast and furious sometimes, and many of us are really focused on the mainstream luxury brands. So it's always a treat to hear of the newcomers talking to you guys.
Yeah,
they're
definitely
really new. They just launched in September, I believe. So even among folks who you know read our site, you know, often you know they might not even be too familiar with them, but I'm looking forward to getting the review on the site relatively soon. It's a cool watch.
Cool.
This is started by the sons of Christopher Ward.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
So there's some pedigree there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sure.
I am wearing the IWC tribute to 3705.
Fancy
today, which is. Yeah, I got to be honest with you guys. When I first saw this watch and took in the look and the specs, I kind of thought, you know, that's not really my jam, right? It's a little big, and you know, it's going to be like pretty thick, and I thought it was going to be pretty heavy, but boy, it's not. It's 41 millimeters, which is maybe a little north of what I usually wear, but the Ceratanium here makes it feel really light, so it's actually very wearable on the wrist.
Yeah.
You know, I think I still prefer the proportions of my 3706, which is 39 millimeters, but if you're going to wear a tall watch, I think this one, I've had this on for the last few days, and you don't even really think about it, and I like watches that I can wear, and I don't really realize that I'm wearing them until I need to look down at my...
That 39 millimeters of yours, Blake, I mean, that's like damn near the perfect IWC, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And it was refreshing this year to see them kind of take a stock of all of their pilot watches and say, you know what, let's just dial it back a little bit.
And it's funny to think between, you know, the two that come to mind is, you know, Rolex and IWC, but like dialing down the sizes on classics. You know, the big pilot now at 43, right? I mean, that's that was a big move.
Yeah, I think that was maybe the most surprising thing, though. I saw, other than that experimental XPL thing,
right?
But moving the big pilot, that which has this kind of like cult following to it. We talked to Chris Granger about it here, and to see it come down to 43, it's like, oh yeah, why? It feels like they always should have been doing this, right? Like who's wearing a 46?
I think they would have gone down to 41. You know, the same way that Panerai a few years ago started shrinking their watches. You know, something for everyone. The Douay, the 38 and 42 millimeter, sort of gender neutral. But I think they would have even gone down to 41, but then you really couldn't call it the big pilot anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a watch too, by the way. You know, that I think the big pilot debuted, I want to say it was 2002 or three. And that back then, because I was on wait list for one, it was almost as difficult to get. There was one big pilot. It was almost as difficult to get as the, you know, a steel Daytona.
Wow.
And my name came up and I got one. And you know, over the years, I bought and sold that watch three times because as much as I loved it, it was just so painful to wear because the rivets on the strap. And if you're an OEM guy like I am, I'm not going to change the strap. I like the strap that was envisioned originally with the watch.
Yeah, interesting.
And I know I'm speaking to the wrong crowd because you guys love accessorizing with straps. But, you know, I like it how it comes. And those rivets right on your bone, it was like, oh, my God. So finally my AD said, you know, you're not allowed to buy this model anymore because we're sick of trading it back. so I moved on from the big pilot. But, you know, and it's crazy to see now so many sport watches doing perpetuals. Like, to me, it was weird to see a Big Pilot perpetual. Yeah. And that's a popular watch, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
But it's I think the biggest news, maybe, from IWC, or at least the thing that had us kind of excited here, was the strap change. Those new straps that have it's like a little button on the back that you can...
That's with your finger,
So you can get, you know, they offer, and they're starting to offer more OEM options, right? For people like you, who are like, yeah, I don't want to go find some crazy-looking strap or whatever. I want to stick with what they envisioned it on. And here are all these options that they actually envisioned their watches on.
No, and that is great because, you know, in early days, 20 years ago, Panerai was such a novelty to get the screwdriver in, right? You get we're changing our, you know, from the rubber that they gave you in the box to the croc strap. And, you know, many of us would just butcher the lugs, you know, every single time. And that's one of my complaints, even on a, you know, so many watches now are not doing quick release, and it's almost impossible even for a watchmaker not to put little scratches on from the spring bars, right? Yeah. I had this strap taken off because I got the Beads of Rice bracelet from the Japanese model. Mm-hmm. And I had a master watchmaker. I said, you know, I don't mind dings and natural patina that I put on my own watches, but I can't stand a sloppy watchmaker. Oh, no, I won't scratch it. But guess what? There's hairline scratches from the spring bars on all four, you know, backs of the lugs.
Jeez.
You know, and it's that Zeratsu polishing. How am I going to get that fixed? You know, it's like driving me nuts. Anyway, that's my rant of the day.
Yeah. I'm still just
amazed. But good for IWC for doing the quick release, like Cartier and so many other, especially Richemont brands.
Yeah.
I mean, I not to make this as a strap conversation, but like, you know, you know, and I really like the IWC solution in terms of the ease of use and just the actual physical execution. It's very like nicely made. But like, do you ever just stop and think, wow, this thing that's worth several thousand dollars is held on by like the single cheapest piece of kit that's on the whole thing? It's a little spring in a tube. And like, I you know, sometimes I think about it, like they should all be screw bars. And like, you know,
I don't disagree. Yeah. I mean, there's the very little that's coming between you and, you know, heartbreak and heartache. Yeah. You know, if you're actually using your watch for what it's intended for. I mean, I just had a conversation about precious metal dive watches. And the question was, do people actually use those for their intended purpose? And the answer is yes. I mean, I know many people that really? Go diving or do sports with, you know, whether it's a Nautilus or a gold sub or whatever. They do, but you know, you think about it, that's some deep water potentially, and you may not get that watch back.
And I've
changed one little malfunction.
I've changed straps for people at the fair, you know, who maybe have never changed their strap before, and they you know, they come and they see our straps and like, oh, that's so cool, and you change it, and like that spring bar is held on by like filled like skin cells that have just collected there, like it's completely rotted away, and it's just like, you know, give them a new set. But anyway, luckily those are not solid gold. I will turn somebody down if they hand me a watch that's too high value, because I'm not changing that. I'm not a master watchmaker.
But if all straps had that system, then you could just solder on the spring bars, like you know, like a Fit 517 or something, and all the straps would just kind of, you know, buckle on like that. I think that'd be pretty cool.
Yeah.
And you have to really trust that buckle. That becomes another point where it could...
I think personally, one of the reasons that so many Richemont brands have shifted over to that quick release and quick sizing, even for their bracelets, like I'm thinking to the, you know, the Santos re-release back 2 years ago, is because, you know, they're really gearing up for more direct to consumer. So, you know, those consumers that might buy it online, not want to go, have any desire to go to a watchmaker to get something fitted. You know, you can do it yourself. You can share it as a couple, you know, quick sizing back and forth. I mean, personally, that's just, I think that's the trend, and that's probably the impetus for it.
Yeah. And it makes a lot of sense. And it's, you know, putting on your e-commerce hat, it's an easy way to increase cart values too. Like you're spending, you know, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, $10,000 on this thing. Like, of course I'm going to pop a few extra straps in my cart if they're offered to me right there that I know I'm going to be able to just clip right on like that and change.
Yeah, sure.
It's a no brainer. And you see Omega doing it too. They put all the NATO straps there on the same page that you see the Speedmaster on. So you can browse, see what your watch is going to look like on all these things. You know, these are $200 NATO straps, but they, you know, they've got the Omega. See, I haven't handled them, so I won't make a judgment on the quality.
No, but I mean, I do think that new Omega Speedmaster Velcro strap is really cool.
Yeah, I like that a lot.
I mean, if you're gonna spend, you know, $215 on a piece of nylon strap.
That's
a pretty cool one.
We've got a lot of Speedies around here. I've reached out to Omega and asked them to send us a few.
They should.
Omega, if you're listening,
yeah,
let's go. Yeah, we got to put these things to the test. Yeah, I like that. I like that Velcro too. That could be a thing there. All right. So before we get into some of the other heavy hitters, I want to circle back to the what were we talking about earlier? The Fair. This is a hand wound chronograph from Fair, right? And it's a Sellita movement.
SW500.
That's in it, like, and it's 12.8 millimeters thick. And this is a $1,900 watch from an independent, small independent brand. How I don't like this is some, this is a measurement that we see a lot of brands struggle with, right? We see a lot of really thick chronograph watches. We even see brands make hand wound chronographs that that have a hard time kind of keeping a trim. How is this something, Reg? Are as you talk to watch brands, like how concerned are they about this kind of stuff? Do they see like, oh, consumers are becoming more and more aware of these certain measurements, and we should cater to these? Like, how is Fair able to do this for a couple of grand? I know it's not the fanciest movement or anything in the world, but they're able to make a case that fits this thing in it. It's under 13 millimeters. Why aren't we seeing these all over the place?
I think, more brands are becoming aware that the consumer is aware of those measurements, and they're becoming more self-conscious of their own measurements. And I think a lot of it is voiced on social media. And, I do think comfort, fit, that all fits in together when you talk about size and shape. So, at the end of the day, the consumer wants something that's comfortable, that fits. When the movement is overly large, it's impossible, obviously, to make the case not feel unwieldy sometimes. So I think, brands, back to that crazy IWC shock absorber that you guys talked to Chris about, they're upping their game technologically and trying to pack more punch into those movements, but to do it in a way that actually makes it, if anything, more svelte, because they leave a lot of options open when they do that. Think about even some Patek Calatravas where, there's a tiny little, like in a 5196 manual wound, there's a big separator even between the movement so small that even on that, whatever it is, 37, 38 millimeter watch, there's a big separator in there, because at least that way, they have room to grow, so they're not being able to fit a movement inside a case. So you just leave more options open when you do that.
I guess that's a good point too. And if you're a smaller, kind of more bespoke company like Fair, you're kind of making it. I guess you're not constrained by the same types of things, maybe.
Yeah, sometimes I feel like though with some of the smaller independent brands, that it's a little bit of almost not being steeped in a history of watchmaking that maybe allows them to design things in ways that are a little bit perhaps outside of the norm, or a little clever in other ways, or ride tolerances in certain ways, like I don't know if at an IWC if they have like you always leave this much clearance between a rotor and a case back or something like that, and then you add that up or something, whereas
back to IWC, Zach, I think Richemont has the benefit of having that basically test lab where they all can share like new innovations, all of the brands, the Richemont brand. So, they have access to, crazy technology. So, the richer brands like that are able to, come out with more innovative use of whether it's silicone or anything else. I do think that there's an advantage that some of those luxury brands have that the independents might not have access to.
Yeah.
Oh, certainly. Yeah.
All right. Let's make the jump over. Let's start talking about some of this stuff.
Some watches and some wonders.
Let's talk about some watches and some wonders here. So this was an all digital show this year, as you may have noticed. Nobody's really traveling, so we're all kind of doing this from our screens. And perhaps you listening were able to jump in on some of that. I think that's one of the benefits here. It's like, it's kind of the same. It's a very like democratic experience, which is pretty cool. So let's just kind of tackle the big one first. Let's talk about Rolex. So Rolex, I think was a big surprise to a lot of people this year. This was the 50th anniversary of the Explorer II, 1971, the reference of 1655. Explorer 2, which was a lovely watch, almost unusual watch, right? So so this is a watch that took their Explorer line. It didn't really share much in terms of visual identity with the Explorer 1, just the Explorer, really. But they added the GMT movement to it. It had a very funky minute track to it. It had a great brushed steel bezel. It is to this day, I think, like one of the most distinctive looking vintage Rolexes you can get. And this is an important watch to vintage collectors. It's been on a lot of people's radar, and this 50th anniversary has been on a lot of people's radars for a long time. The 40th anniversary, this is when they made the switch from the five digit references over to the 6-digit references, and this was when they went from a 40 millimeter case at best to the 42 millimeter case. They gave it the big orange hand. They gave it the maxi dial. A very different watch from the 5-digit that I know at least a few of us here have owned in the past and loved.
Absolutely.
You know, I think there was a lot of hopes and speculations. What are they going to do? They changed the case size of the sub. Are they going to do the same to the Explorer 2? Are they going to put it down into that 41 millimeter case? Is it going to get a ceramic bezel? Is it going to have a green hand to mark the anniversary? And no, none of those things happened. No. In fact, you would be hard pressed, even if you're a watch person, to look at the both of them side by side and not be able to tell them apart. It visually looks exactly the same. I know they said it's a redesigned case, and I'm sure that the proportions here and there have been changed. I haven't had it in my hand yet, so I can't really say. Maybe it is much better. But it sticks to the same design language. It gets the new movement that the GMT watches have been receiving, so it's great. What happened here? Reg, what were you expecting?
Rolex is such a weird company. First of all, I nor anyone else on the planet, if you don't work for Rolex, no one knows what Rolex is going to do or what goes through the executives' minds. But I do know that in over three decades of loving and collecting Rolex, it's a weird company. You know, think back to Blake, that 1655, the original Explorer 2 you mentioned. I mean, think of a company that develops a watch for spelunking, for cave exploration. I mean, those booklets, I believe, still instruct you how to tell, you know, the time between day and night if you're a cave explorer. So, yeah. You know, people think of Rolex now as this luxury brand, and it is, but they're problem solvers. You know, they like to always improve. You know, the watches that they make, yes, they're luxury timepieces, but they're also indestructible almost. I mean, more than most other brands I can think of.
Yeah.
But along that evolution, I mean, and just to quietly on this big anniversary, or just to quietly make improvements like that, whether it's the movement or the, you know, improved chromolite luminous.
Yeah.
It's, you know, they're always just sort of a couple of years ago when they, maybe it's three or four now, but the Explorer 1, the 39 millimeter, they made that change. You know, they just quietly improved the legibility of the 369 by putting luminous in it. Mm-hmm. They took the T-Rex, you know, we named it the T-Rex because we thought it had
short hands.
It didn't reach the minute track. Yeah. So they quietly improved that. I think they maybe tweaked the bezel, but they wouldn't really own up to that. Mm-hmm. It's always just these quiet little improvements, you know, but let's shift gears to the Explorer 1. Because that was a big one. Yeah. That was a big one.
Yeah, it was. So the Explorer 1, I don't know anybody that foresaw this coming, got a new model that is a Rolosaur, what is Rolex's term for bimetal. So this is a steel mixed with yellow gold. Yeah, you heard that correctly. It's the base Explorer now has a two-tone option. It also, perhaps equally as important, moves back to its original 36 millimeter case, which it always has been. It shares a mid case now with the Oyster Perpetual line, I believe. So it is a slightly different design. Which of these was the bigger surprise to you, Reg?
I mean, that was a surprise, but I think shrinking down to 36, which to me is the perfect size. I mean, I'm a long time Explorer 1. I've got a 1016 from 1967. I mean, that's the perfect size. That's what an Explorer 1 should be. So I'm thrilled. For me, the steel one, I mean, actually, I've got one. I called my AD. I'm like, oh my God. So put me down for that for sure. So. The bad news, though, with Rolex is, unlike its cousin or brother, little brother Tudor, the Tudor watches are now available. So, you know, just yeah. like George Kern and Breitling's doing yeah. is, you know, they're available now. With Rolex, we still have to wait at least 6 months, you know, agonizingly long wait where you get excited and then you're like, ugh. But anyway, back to the two-tone. You know, Rolex, it's not that unusual for Rolex to do that. I mean, think of even the Deep Sea Special that was, which was, you know, they made a version on a two-tone back. Yeah. When was that? The 60s, you know, and they've, yeah, they've yeah. done two-tone Submariner since, I think, the 70s. So, you know, two-tone on a Rolex sport watch, you know, Tudor's done it. So it was a little unusual, but I get it. Mm-hmm. And it's a weird one, though, because all throughout social media, the people you talk to, people either love it or they despise it. So yeah. it's either ridiculed or like, I'm getting one from my wife and we're going to share it and I want one too. Mm-hmm. And it's the coolest thing I've ever seen. It's crazy.
It's such a funny thing. I mean, because, you know, on one hand, you have the what happened with the Explorer 2, which is a complete lack of fan service, as it might, you know, have been seen, and Rolex being Rolex in its way. And then the Explorer 1, which is... like I would imagine is the Explorer fan's dream, is the modernized, you know, the most modern and the most original
dream.
Version of it.
Dream.
But then there, you know, is that for you? Is that like, what was the actual impetus behind that? Was that to do fan service, or are they, is it because they play with sizes and this is about changing the way the market is? Maybe the 39 millimeter just lived long enough and there's or something. I'm curious because it's like, seems like two different brains, or, you know, one is so strategic and quality of life focused, and then this feels like it's for,
I think, you know, I think part of the answer is, you know, that move towards gender neutrality and offering sizes and not sexist so much. I mean, think of what Rolex did back September 1st mm-hmm. with the Oyster Perpetuals, where they have it, you know, ranging from what, 28 to 41 millimeter and everything in between, you know, so men and women alike can just choose their size and, you know, their configuration. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I mean, I feel like more brands are doing that. The size is not sexist thing. And I think it's a smart play. Mm-hmm. Another thing Rolex did, which was interesting. I don't mean to switch us off Explorers too fast, but that green leaf dial Datejust, you know, I think more brands, back to Grand Seiko. I think that was a direct shot at Grand Seiko, because the messaging, you know, the nature messaging and, you know, the nature of time, the Grand Seiko celebrates, you know, they celebrate Japanese nature, Japanese culture, and bring that into the product, like with the white birch that we were talking about.
Yeah.
I do think there've been several brands that have recognized Grand Seiko's messaging and tried to emulate that a bit. Even the Mighty Rolex. Mm. I do think that was a bit of a tip of the hat almost, or a wink at, hey, we get what you're doing. We're gonna, you know, we're perpetual ocean exploration and conservation. We're a nature loving company too. We're gonna celebrate that just a touch, you know, with this green leaf or whatever they're calling that dial.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. Zach Kazan, did you have any thoughts on that? Like, did you connect that when you saw that?
Yeah, so it kind of felt to me like they can sort of like, I don't know, like feel the heat coming around the corner from Grand Seiko a little bit, like. I feel like, you know, Grand Seiko is really kind of like on an upswing, you know, like they're a brand that a lot of people have gone towards when they can't get a Rolex, because it's something we haven't really talked about, is that, you know, these stainless steel Rolex models are impossible to get. So when you go to an authorized dealer and you're told it's going to be a year or more, or there is no wait list and you're just going to be out of luck, you have to switch to something else and pivot to something else. And I think Grand Seiko is really taken advantage of that in the last few years, and people have turned to them. And to me, it feels like the palm dial and the fluted dials that they introduced this week feel kind of like a response to that a little bit. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'd call it like a tip of the cap or not, but it's just you know, like they're trying. It's a sector of these like textured dials that they see an opening for themselves with, I guess. And
Rolex too, Zach. They, throughout history, they've been, you know, they've made very strange and exotic dials where they're made out of onyx or petrified wood. Think about some of the weird dials, right? Mm-hmm. Lapis lazuli, mm-hmm. meteorite. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, Rolex has been kind of a pioneer there, but I think I don't know, part of it's the messaging, the really strong nature messaging. I think that, that Grand Seiko's been able to, without using brand ambassadors or anything, just really messaging that nature message.
Yeah.
But just to stay on Rolex for a second, I think it's gotten so frustrating to go into Rolex boutiques for many of us. You know, if we're traveling, that's always been something for me over decades, just fun to go into a Rolex boutique, see what they have, talk to the salespeople. But now it is purely frustration and a total waste of time.
Yeah.
Because there's so few watches in the case that Rolex now, I know an AD that just had to do a rebuild, a Rolex rebuild. And Rolex has shipped some trays to go in the cases with zero cavities in it. So it doesn't look like the watches are missing. So they have this case, and many of the cases now just sit with these empty, you know, the trays, but with no cavities, because any of the good stuff that comes in, any steel stuff, any steel Oyster Perpetuals, it's not just the Daytona or the professional models anymore. It's like a steel date chest takes months to get. Yeah. And that never sees the light of day inside the case. So, you know, a regular consumer who wants to go shop and look at Rolexes cannot do so.
Yeah.
And it's just a strange phenomenon in luxury retail.
And not even just regular consumers, even collectors. I have seen a lot of people in on Rolex collector forums just say, look, I'm just not going to play this game. I'm switching over to other brands. Mm-hmm. And then they start exploring the Grand Seikos of the world.
They do. They do. It gets frustrating. The Grunfelds of the world, like, whatever. I don't know if I want to be that person anymore, you know, buying luxury new Rolex. So definitely a thought that goes into it.
And speaking like personally, maybe coming to a point in my life where something like a $6,400 36 millimeter Explorer would be a potential purchase. Now knowing knowing the process, knowing the hype, knowing all these things, like it's very much a preventative barrier to even consider it. I feel like I'm not allowed to have it a little bit. Do you know what I mean?
Well, you can just walk in and say, I am the co-founder.
80s don't know me. I buy everything
I'm
off
kind
forums.
Of a big deal. Yeah.
You know, like maybe I can buy it on Reddit, you know, but.
Oh,
yeah.
You know what's funny though, Zach, it's like over the years as a lifelong Rolex lover, there have been times where I haven't owned a Rolex just to see what it would feel like. And to me, it does feel like something's missing. It's crazy, but it's like,
wow. That's interesting.
Sometimes it's a go-to watch. I remember a bunch of us years ago went on a retailer sponsored trip to Lange, you know, in Germany. And that was just a phenomenal trip to go see that, you know, amazing machine get made. And, you know, we all get on the plane. We're wearing Langes, you know, supporting the brand. We get on the plane. It's probably like 10 out of 12 of us reach into our bag and throw our Rolexes back on. You know, it's just comfort. It's like it's just a watch you can do anything with and you don't have to ever worry about it. I don't know. It's a strange, weird phenomenon.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. All right. Let's jump over to something else and get off. We may have shed too many of our listeners here.
We do. You know what? We should talk about Tudor quick, though.
No. I think we should jump over to Tudor because that's, I think, the more maybe relevant brand here. And they released two new Black Bay 58s, but probably not the Black Bay 58s that we were thinking were going to come. And I think we've been waiting for more 58s for years now. And we're still sitting at two steel models, but they added two precious metal models. And one of them is silver.
God, I mean, had it been April Fool's Day, I would have thought, wow, is Rolex actually making an April Fool's Day joke? You know, that was just sick. The sterling silver one to do, first of all, a dive watch in sterling silver that is malleable. It's a soft metal. It's easily, you know, tarnishable, especially exposed to salt water. And I know they alloy their own precious metals. And I think this one's probably no exception. And they're going to, you know, take the copper out and do whatever they need to do to make it tarnish resistant. But that combined with the see-through case back, I mean, it was so non-Rolex, you know what I mean? But I think those two models, 18 karat gold and sterling silver, full disclosure, I think I'm getting my sterling tomorrow. It's crazy. I just was like, this is a cool watch. I mean, what is it?
This is something I can't think of another sterling silver watch. Like, I mean, maybe no. I just it's very weird.
Especially
it's
one that's marketed as like a rugged tool watch.
Right? Yeah. Regardless, it's like back you get in the 1930s, Rolex and other brands did use sterling silver in watch cases, but that was still during almost like experimental watch manufacturing, because that was the birth of it.
Exactly. It was
but yeah, it's very, very strange. But I think it will bring, you know, a different consumer to pay attention to that brand, you know, that that they may not have had before. I don't know. It's almost, I don't know. I just think.
Yeah.
Well, it's certainly like, I mean, if you know, I'm trying to think of like the consumer who might maybe not be aware of the brand and go into the store and they want something precious and they don't know the context, how weird it is to have a silver watch. And it's suddenly though, but you know, silver is precious.
Silver.
And you know, this watch now is under $5,000.
Yeah, it's a good price.
And it's by great the price. Brand that's related to Rolex. So it's kind of like.
Perfect size, you know? 39 millimeter. Yeah. Come on.
And it's pretty. I mean, I think it's undeniably watch. Attractive watch. So
it's really nice.
I mean, I wish they had done that rivet bracelet too in sterling silver. That would just be.
Oh, that would have been
ridiculous.
Because I'm a bracelet lover more than straps, so that's the only negative for me. But I don't know. I think that was just ballsy move.
Zach Kazan, you got $17,000 burning a hole in your pocket. Are you buying a precious metal Tudor?
I would definitely buy the silver one. I'm not really too interested in the gold, but you know, I'm not really a big Black Bay 58. Fan in general. I've never you know, the gilt dial and the blue dial are nice watches, but when those were released, I didn't think I have to have this watch, but I kind of like feel compelled to like at least try one of these silver ones on. It's very unusual, and I it kind of reminds me in a way of the P01, in that it's just completely wild and unpredictable and just not it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. And I think that the difference between the silver Black Bay 58 and the P01 is that the silver Black Bay 58 is like really desirable, like to I think a wide segment of people, while still being quite weird in the context of the rest of their catalog and dive watches in general. It's a very strange thing, but I'm intrigued by it.
Yeah. Very curious to see what it looks like in person, because every photo, including theirs, I would say it looks blown out. You know, like they say, it's very vibrant. It's very like it illuminates, but it's almost it's white in photos. You know,
and when we were talking to them, she said it's like it's brighter, it's lighter. I don't know what, but it's interesting. And I don't know who's buying a solid gold, you know, $17,000. Tudor, I feel like that gets up into some, you know, there's some serious watches up in that territory.
I agree with you, Blake. I mean, Tudor's all about value, and I think as soon as you start departing from that value proposition, it's, you know, you're where else could your dollars be spent?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It's like when the first Apple Watch came out in that 18 karat version. I think that was $13,000 or $16,000 too. Remember?
Yeah.
I know a couple of watch dealers that speculated on it, but they got killed because there was no resale market for it.
Yeah, and now it's bricked.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
How much was the Rolexor Explorer? Do you know?
10,000 and change.
So would you go for solid gold Tudor, or, you know, assuming both were like obtainable from a store at the same moment?
I would take the two-tone Explorer. Only because my wife texted me as soon as it dropped in. I want that.
But you
watch.
Know what I mean? But like, so not only is it kind of a hard value within their own company, but then you can cross compare back to Rolex, and then you have some really strong options.
And it says
options,
Rolex on the dial.
You know?
Yeah.
It says Rolex. It's going to have a better resale value, which is something I think about when I'm buying watches too. So, you know, some of us don't buy and keep forever. So I think, you know, that resale is something that needs to be considered sometimes.
Yeah. So they had another couple of watches that were sadly not the Pelagos, but which we were kind of like low key hoping for something new there. It was a Black Bay chronograph. So they launched these in what looked like, I feel like this is what the Black Bay chronograph should have been from the get go when they introduced that a few years back, with a panda and reverse panda dials, screw down pushers, bracelets, the whole nine yards. And so they brought the minute track inside of the dial. Some people say it looks like a Neumann or some vintage-esque Rolex. I don't quite get that vibe from it. But if you do, that's great. I think there's some nice design details here. This is a design that just in general, though, does not quite click with me for some reason. I don't know. What do you guys think of this?
I mean, I like it. I'm looking at pictures of it now. I think they did, what is that, 41 millimeter too?
Yeah, it is 41 yeah. millimeter, and I think yeah. a 14.5, 14.4.
I mean, I think between the rivet bracelet and the two configuration, I don't know. I think it's. I never loved the Black Bay Chrono before, yeah. but these ones I really like.
Yeah.
I really like.
Yeah, I think this is getting a lot of different, because when they initially launched, they were like the bicolor and right, they had some kind of strange configurations. So these kind of feel more in line with what, you know, we would expect here. I'm sad that we didn't see anything in those heritage chronograph lines. I do hope they come back to those. I really do like those chronographs. And I know we were speculating when Breitling did their releases, they released the hand-wound BO9, I think it was called, with the pistachio dial. I like that watch, by the way. That's very sharp. Since they have the sharing movement thing, I wondered, are we going to see this make an appearance over in Tudor? I know there's maybe not a precedent for a hand-wound chronograph movement over a Tudor, but I think that I would have welcomed a watch that had that movement in it from Tudor. But we didn't. We got these instead. So, Zach Kazan, what did you...
I think Rolex, you know, the Rolex house has gotten away completely from manual wound.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. They used to do it, obviously. Yeah. They used to do it with some Cellinis. I don't think anything anymore with Rolex, even any Cellini. I think it's all perpetual.
Yeah.
Automatic.
Zach Kazan, what did you think of these Black Bay chronographs?
I like these a lot more than the original iteration of the Black Bay chronograph. I'll be curious to handle one at some point and see how they managed to slim down the case. When we saw them in our kind of virtual presentation, they still looked kind of thick to me, even though they claim they've shaved about a millimeter off of the case height. So we'll see. I think it's an attractive watch, just continues to kind of like build out the Black Bay line.
Yeah. I think, yeah, overall, I don't know. Every time you go into this, you have kind of an expectation, and then it's just never anywhere near the ballpark. So I guess you just kind of learn to live with it, right?
I mean, guys, how about that crazy reverso, huh?
Yes, we've all been kind of chatting about this one. If we're qualified
to even
look at it.
I know.
I mean, can you it's like 11 complications and 4 faces, something like that?
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Yeah. The quadriptych. Yeah.
Quadriptych.
Quadriptych. Yeah. Which but they did also release, it's just like a small seconds reverso too, right? With a
yeah.
red dial,
yeah.
or a green dial. Those are
another green dial.
Shocking.
Green
with a green dial.
Everything's green.
Green dial. All right, yeah. Should we go there? Like, what is going on? All of a sudden, the green is just like exploding everywhere.
It takes Switzerland 2 years to meet up with like the, you know, like it's finally happened. Everyone talked about it a few years ago, and now it's reaching peak.
Yeah,
right?
Everyone
it's
said like, green is going to be the new blue, and now we've got just another, I guess, another option against blue. Even Patek weighed into this territory with the 5711, which you can now get in an olive green dial. And we don't have to dwell on Patek or anything, but I got the sense that when this came out, that it was just kind of a collective like groan of like, oh, okay. Is the 5711 stuff, is this just kind of like jump the shark and I don't know. Like even like everyone is just kind of I'm done talking and thinking about this, and you know it's
hard, you know. And plus this is like, you know, Thierry Stern said this is kind of the swan song of the current lineup, sort of a tribute and an homage to this, you know, line that debuted on the anniversary year of 06. You know, I don't know, in recent the whole Nautilus craze over the last 2 or 3 years, is it a bubble? You know, it's hard to say. Maybe when they do the new line, which they will, that'll cool things off with the speculators. But, you know, a regular steel 5711 right now is trading at like, it could be $100,000, you know, and if it's got Tiffany on the dial, double it. So it's like.
Yeah. And it's the same thing with the 15202 right now, which they announced very early. They were just going to discontinue, which did not help anybody that was maybe going to be looking for one of those at any kind of reasonable price.
Yeah. The Royal Oak craze is nothing different. I mean, it's a craze. It is a craze.
Well, this is what makes the world that we like to live in so much more fun, because these are watches that are accessible from brands, you know, like Ferrer and Oris, in Oris Head, let's talk about these new Diver 65 watches with these cotton candy dials.
Which,
look at this. Look at this. It's like bright blue, green, and pink, kind of pastelish. But maybe more importantly, this is a new case size for the Diver 65.
That's what's exciting,
yeah,
particularly to me. Yeah, 38. They had 36. They had 40. Well, there's many sizes. There's the 40, 42. Their chronographs are 43. Then they later introduced the 36. And the 36, which is, I believe, the same size as whatever the original model from 1965 was, does feel small, like when you put it on your wrist, especially if you're used to that 40. But having owned the 40, I always found that because of the size, the crown dug into my hand, which would only be worse at the slightly larger size. So I'm wondering, is this the Goldilocks Diver 65, finally?
Yep, and this is how they're introducing it. It's great. And I hope that they release, as fun as these are, you know, I hope that they release just kind of
I can't wear a solid bronze bracelet. My hand will turn green. So
and with the dial color that's like that, maybe like a couple days out of the year or something. Yeah. You know, when you're like drinking beers at the beach.
I mean, it's fun.
You know what's crazy to think about with Oris is I want to say it was only 2015 that they resurrected that line and recreated the Diver 65. And now, if you close your eyes and you think of Oris, you think of Diver 65. You know, that's the thing. It's like Tudor. What's Tudor? Okay, it's a black bag. You know, it's like. It's just had such phenomenal success and, you know, good brand leadership too there.
Yeah.
I've got to say.
Yeah, absolutely. With Rolf, we like him a lot. And they introduced the new, in-house movement, that was an automatic, with the 10-year warranty. We've gone over that one. So I hope to see that make an appearance in just regular Diver 65.
It's going
to
make it
in this case size.
Yeah. That'd be cool.
Yes, let's it would.
Make it happen, Rolf. Please.
And then make it in sterling silver, please.
And then make it in sterling silver. Or don't. So what, let's see here. What, Zach Kazan, what else caught your eye?
Oh, man. So there are a lot of things that caught my eye, but like not in a great way. Do we want to talk about some of the things that like didn't quite work? Are we at that point?
Maybe it works for the rest of us. So throw it out.
So,
can we talk about the Panerai, the $60,000 recycled Panerai with the Internet Explorer logo on the dial?
Yeah. So like, you said it. I wanted to. Yeah. I don't want anybody else to say it. So what is
You know, I agree with you, Zach. I mean, you know, Panerai and Richemont overall, like other luxury houses, are really trying to message that sustainability, especially to the younger luxury consumer who really thinks, you know, differently than maybe more mature luxury consumers do and more mindful about the environment. And so they've been playing with recycled rubber, Panerai specifically, and, you know, now recycled steel. I mean, that's great, but this is a luxury item and think about how little steel actually goes into that case. So it's not exactly like, you know, making a green, eco-friendly office building that's going to really have an impact on carbon footprint. Mm-hmm. I don't know that it justifies any kind of high price like that. It's, to me, it's a bit of a novelty.
This should be just like the ante to play. Like, this should be just a base. Like, of course, we use whatever recycled materials we can to make our watches. We, you know, we don't have to put it on the dial. Like, that's just the obvious thing to do.
Yeah.
It's also
we don't have to celebrate on the dial. Just do it and tell us later. Right?
A lot of, from what I understand from various, you know, talking to various people at companies, a lot of steel already has at least some level of a recycled
content. That's what I was
thinking
too. Yeah.
But then certainly like RPET straps and whatever, like, not that surprising. I mean, you can find that very affordably, you know, 111, Spinnaker, these are brands that use RPET.
Yeah.
You know, so it's great to use it, but it's, don't try and slap a huge price tag and necessarily like a slogan because you're doing that now.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
That logo is really, that would drive me nuts looking down that thing all the time.
How did that get through?
It's an otherwise perfectly handsome watch, I think. Yeah. And I think if they, you know, I want just like a, to me, that's the beauty of a Panerai. And I'm not like a huge Panerai guy or anything, but they've got their look. And I think when they do it well, it really works. And I think some of these new watches look great. And they've got this bright blue teal logo that's E-Steel. It, you know, it feels like the guy that comes up to you and is like, you know, like your old uncle or something. And he's like, you know, I'll send you an electronic mail or yeah, something. You know, they write it with the Lori. Like, right. It feels like just kind of that out of touch. Like,
yeah.
Do you it's really also, know it? I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's bizarre. But it's also just like, don't make a watch out of it. Because now you're also highlighting, like, well, what are the rest of your watches made out of? But it's like, just say, institutionally now, we are going to make watches with no less than 75%
right. Across the board.
Yeah. Or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, the same way that like a brand like Gucci said, you know, a couple of years ago, we're going to stop using fur. Across the board, yeah. You know, like mm-hmm. just make a new policy and then that's what you're going to be known for.
Yeah. All right, Zach, what else did you hate?
Yeah, this is fun yeah, game. Like...
I don't want to dwell too much on the negative stuff. So something else that I really liked that I wrote about on the site was the new Bulgari Octofinissimo Tadao Endo mm-hmm. Collaboration.
Yeah.
Just a really beautiful version of that watch with a really great blue dial with a yellow crescent moon accent, which Blake, you pointed out to me, looks like a banana, which now I can't unsee. Yeah,
sorry.
But I think that's the Warhol okay. edition. It's still, still very cool looking. And I love that watch. I love the Octofinissimo. I think it's really, really beautiful. Wow. Kind of a, you know, it's a modern classic, a future classic.
100% modern classic, you know, innovative design. That whole line is just... You know, I'm looking at the Perpetual now, and it's just, you know, it's a different, very cool watch.
Yeah, it's cool to look at the two kind of side by side. Because I mean, talking about Grand Seiko vibes to me, the Tadao Endo collaborations kind of always had that, you know, sort of like a artistic sort of approach. I mean, you know, obviously they got rid of markers and everything, and they went kind of purely into the sensation or something, the poetry of it, whereas, you know, Grand Seiko always kind of mixes in practicality as well. But still, it's just that kind of use of a dial as a canvas. But then you look at the Perpetual, and like, I'm seeing those older the Daniel Roth Bulgaris in the sort of a different era.
Yeah.
And I don't dislike it, but it's starkly different.
It is very different, yeah. And the whole just case in general. I mean, if you look from the edge of the dial to the edge of the lug, there's... You know, it looks like there's about 50 different surfaces in there. and I've not had one of these on my wrist. Reg, have you worn an Octofinissimo?
You know, I haven't worn one. I respect it. And so many, you know, serious watch people that we all know own them and respect them as well. You know, I do think it was a nod to the great Gerald Genta, who, you know, along with, you know, designing, of course, classics like the Royal Oak, like the Nautilus, he came up with the design for the Bulgari watch. So I think they thought a little bit about Gerald Genta and brought him into the, you know, that his soul and his design aesthetic into that line. And I just think, you know, it's been nothing but home run for the brand.
Yeah, they certainly have tapped into something here with their Octofinissimos.
I was thinking, do you have any sense in terms of the movements, like how do they compare in terms of fit, finish, and kind of like quality to, you know, a longer? I mean, obviously the level of fit, hand finish is different, but, you know, you're looking at Perpetual calendars here, and I know there's sort of like an art to making those, you know.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that's, again, like I would love to see one in person to get a sense of these, their movements. I know that there's maybe some compromise happening because they are exceedingly thin, right? That's like
a record breaker.
That's their thing.
They make the world's thinnest mechanical movement, right? So,
yeah.
I think for me, like Zach, you mentioned Longa. I mean, just having seen those guys in the workshop making that second to none, even Patek movement. You know, there's at Longa, there's four engravers that sit next to each other facing the window, and they're looking out into a nature, into a courtyard. And if you hand them your Longa, they can instantly look and they'll point to which one of them did the hand finishing on the back because they recognize each other's work.
Yeah, it's like a fingerprint.
You know, and you know, when you look at like a datagraph or a split seconds Longa, and you're just, it's like looking into a chasm, you know, it's just so 3D. So I think you lose a little bit of that soul, for me personally, when you make an ultra thin mechanical movement.
Yeah.
It's just, you don't see the depths and that negative space, you know, between, you know, gears and bridges, you know,
yeah,
just
sure.
it's different.
Yeah. And Bulgari definitely, Bulgari, Bulgari. Listen to me, that's my Wisconsin coming out. The Bulgari, but I mean, look at the bridges and the plates on the back. They have just a very straightforward, almost industrial looking.
Well, yeah, I imagine it's much more industrial manufactured, but yeah. I'm also just curious, like, because a perpetual calendar is such like a complex mechanism, like what their solution was, how they got it that thin, how reliable it is, just all those things. I mean, it's. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember when AP did that ultra thin perpetual calendar Royal Oak, and they had talked about engineering it like you're taking like a 3-story house and like flattening it all onto a single story, but still fitting all the things that were on each of those floors onto the same floor of the house, and you're like collapsing it all into a single level.
That's cool to think about.
So I'd be curious to know because I'm sure that certain components had to be designed and engineered to account for multiple things that would normally be separate components stacked on top of each other or something like that. I don't know, but
it's an edge. I do think engineering was a number one going into that design of that movement for sure.
Yeah, it's cool. All right, so let's wrap up. I want to get to kind of each of your biggest surprises from the show. Zach Weiss.
Biggest surprise. I mean, the biggest surprise was the silver Tudor. I never ever could have predicted that they would make a silver dive watch, but we've already gone over that, so I'm gonna say that yellow hublot, because I was like, that's,
you're surprised at how much you like it.
Yeah, I mean, almost. It's like, that is just kind of funky. I kind of dig the yellow, but I'm not really a hublot fan or a fan of the watch overall, but like yellow ceramic, kind of neat. So I'll just say
I try to write about hublot all the time, and Zach has to stop from doing this. So
But no, I mean, you got to give credit where
it's funny. Hublot is one of those brands where it's so polarizing. And here in the U.S., watch guys generally hate it, despise it, look down on it. But everywhere else in the world, it's a super popular luxury brand. You know, if you're a professional soccer player, you're going to wear Hublot. So
overall, their aesthetic has grown on me, in the sense that I like don't find it. Like, I think it was just too much when I first got into like watches and things, and like, the kind of super modern. Very, there's so much going on, just very busy, that look just didn't appeal to me. And now I'm more used to it, more accustomed, but I also feel like they might have toned down a little bit, or their styling has gotten a little bit sharper. I'm not saying this is like my grail watch, but yellow ceramic, just knowing about it, also ceramic manufacturing, how hard it is, that's something that they are pioneers of, as well as a couple other brands. And I mean, it's just yellow and black. It looks kind of cool. And I know I saw people ragging on it on Instagram. It's just it's take it at face value. It's neat.
Yeah. You know? And it's an easy thing to do. And I know we kind of like snicker and all that. But all respect completely where it's due to Hublot. They do some cool stuff. Absolutely. Zach Kazan, biggest surprise.
We already talked about, some of the, to me, the biggest surprise is, I think, the dropping of size and the Explorer is a big surprise. Obviously, the silver Black A58 is a big surprise. Something else that I was surprised by was the return of the Zenith Defy Extreme line. That line is one of probably the most universally hated lines of watches produced by a major brand. Mm-hmm. For them to go back to the well and kind of like reshape the Defy Extreme is a pretty interesting choice. And I think that the watch itself is it's an $18,000 high frequency chronograph. It's a niche product and it's huge, but it's a pretty interesting watch in the context of Zenith's catalog and history with the Defy, and the original Defy Extreme from the Terry Nataf era is something that's always kind of fascinated me. So I was very surprised to see them bring that back. I was not expecting that.
Yeah, and we've got a piece of editorial coming on the Defy, so
yes,
gird your loins for that one, everybody. So I'll Reg, I'll let you have the final word. So I'll just jump in here with my surprise was what we didn't say. I'm still in shock about the Explorer 2, what they didn't do with it. I don't know why. It's the 50th anniversary. This is like, you know, if this was my marriage and I just like remembered on the way home. So I swung into like 7-Eleven and got like a big gulp and, you know, some flowers or something and said, oh, happy anniversary. It's
not
like
big gulp bad. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. It's not that bad, but it's just,
it's like you change the tires on her car instead of, or something.
Yeah,
it's like,
no, yeah,
Blake,
the trip to Paris,
I don't disagree with you. I do think they should have done somewhat of a tribute to for that big anniversary. I think back to the 50th anniversary of the Submariner. They came out with the Kermit in 03.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, that was a,
and that changed the trajectory of the whole Submariner line.
Yeah,
right.
It did.
What's the same?
So
do you?
Yeah, I think that was a miss. But you know, my biggest surprise, my biggest, you know, was what we talked about, that Tudor, you know, in sterling silver. The gold one wasn't that much of a surprise, but that was big. That combined with the display case back for Tudor, it's just such a departure.
What such do you think that this is the last that we will see from these brands this year? This was the other thing kind of in the back of my head, like maybe Rolex does have something in store and we just haven't seen it yet, like, and they're just going to save it for late.
I mean, I think the rules have changed, right? I think, look at, you know, we talked Seiko and Grand Seiko throughout all last year, pre-pandemic even, they were, their 60th anniversary last year, Grand Seiko was doing
these digital announcements,
new releases all the time, Fast and Furious. I think the rules have changed. You know, Rolex last year, along with Patek, said, no trade show. We're not doing new releases. You know, I know enough collectors who have direct access to Thierry Stern that I know for a fact he finally gave in, and all these collectors were saying, no, we want the new releases. So last summer, he did provide some new releases, and then Rolex followed suit with their September 1 sub and OP new releases. So I just feel like, you know, whether you're George Kern controlling Breitling, full control, do what you want, or, you know, a mighty brand like Rolex, Patek Philippe, or other brands, I think the rules have changed. They're not relying on trade shows. You can reach your audience now with social media. You know, all of the journalists, I don't think any industry is as well covered as our watch industry is. And you guys cover it so well, and, you know, from every single angle. And, you know, I feel like the manufacturers understand that now, and they can tap right into it and get right into that consumer's pocketbook and wallet.
Yeah,
I think it would kind of make sense if a brand like, say, Tudor has a, you know, like a Black Bay 58 GMT that they're, you know, that they're working on. Wouldn't it kind of make sense for them to release that in, like, in this day and age where they can reach their, you know, their clientele directly, to put that out kind of like at a, you know, like in the summer or something, outside the context of a trade show, where they could have the spotlight, you know, like kind of all to themselves for a while. That's why the blue Black Bay 58 that came out last year, it had no competition around it, and it was all that we saw on social media and watch media for, you know, a solid week, and it was a kind of a like a crossover phenomenon.
It absolutely was, Zach. That Black Bay Blue last summer was the shot in the arm for Tudor that it didn't even need, but, you know, it actually accelerated their growth and their climbing, you know, up the charts, especially in the U.S. And, you know, one big hit like that really can do wonders for a brand, even a brand like Tudor.
Yeah. I hope to see more of that. I mean, Zenith did the same thing earlier this year with that Chronomaster Sport thing that everyone said looks like a Daytona. I mean, that's all anyone talked about for like a week and a half. You know, I mean, if they had released it just this week, it would have just been a side note.
You get lost. Yeah, you can get lost in the shuffle.
Yeah, no, own the moment and get the product to the ADs in time for people to actually purchase them, and you're golden.
Absolutely.
That two-tone Rolex Explorer is growing on me. I'm just going to say that. Maybe knowing that it's not liked as much, and then people are like, oh, there's no history for that. It's like, they're making history now.
Yeah,
you're
okay,
living
okay,
through
that's,
history.
That's a valid argument, Zach. You know? I like that. Okay. I like that. I like it better than the Hermes HO8 thing. So I'll just say that.
I have to look at that more, but a little surprise. It's a little harsh for me or something.
Yeah.
I mean, Hermes has in recent years have been doing some really cool watches, but again, it's that price point.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to spend those dollars on an Hermes when you're now in, you know, annual calendar Patek territory, you know?
And their slim Hermes were just absolutely gorgeous. I mean, they've been on a tear the last few years.
That's lighting in a bottle.
Yeah.
You can't, you know.
Yeah. Okay, well, what did you think of the releases? Let us know down in the comments below. What did you hate? What did you love? What do you plan on buying? What were you expecting from the Explorer 2 anniversary? Let us know, and we'll talk about it on the next one. Reg Brock, thank you so much for joining us today.
We thanks, really guys. It was my pleasure.
All right, until next time, thanks for listening.
See ya.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Worn & Wound Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, then please leave us a review on iTunes, and also be sure to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Looking for a new watch, a strap? Then visit windupwatchshop.com, and of course, head over to wornandwound.com daily for great watch content. Music tracks Nowhereland and Inspired are by Kevin MacLeod and are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution 3.0.